This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 5th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 141. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. The Big Deal feature. 2020 is half over, the year that feels like it's a decade. Listen to highlights from the Breaker.News from the first half of 2020. Plus, I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or do Canada and other nations have to start now to threaten a boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing? More bad news about China's so-called demographic genocide in mostly Muslim Xinjiang, where more than a million people are in concentration camps because they are Muslim. Meanwhile, the 23rd anniversary of Britain's 1997 handover of Hong Kong to China was marked by a new national security law imposed by Beijing that criminalized free speech. Hong Kong riot police displayed a new purple banner at a protest rally on July 1st, where they threatened to arrest anyone with signs advocating Hong Kong independence. And they did just that. And they also harassed and assaulted journalists, too. This is not the one country, two systems for at least 50 years that Beijing promised the world in 1997. It is an expansion of the Chinese Communist Party dictatorship in a city where there are as many as 300,000 Canadians. Now, I love the Olympics, and we need them to bring the world together in peaceful rivalry. But sport cannot and should not be used by someone like Xi Jinping for the glory of the Chinese Communist Party. The world already saw this movie before. It was called the 1936 Berlin Summer Olympics and 1936 Winter Olympics in Bavaria. Adolf Hitler's celebration of German supremacy 5 years before the Nazi Holocaust. It's time to tell Xi Jinping that enough is enough. Threaten a boycott. It may be the last chance the world has to stop history from repeating. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. What? Dr. Henry says, we're gonna have to wait to vaccinate. So just stay strong and sing this song. You gotta wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Clip from John Mitchell and his Vancouver independent single, Do What?
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
Jeffy Lam, Sum Lok Kai, and Kimmy Chung in the South China Morning Post. National security law is chanting Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times now illegal. City's lawyers aren't so sure. Government's equating protester slogan with call for independence premature as decision lies in the hands of the courts, Bar Association chief says. Legal scholar, pro-establishment heavyweight, agree guilt based on chanting alone would be hard to prove. But Hong Kongers have come up with creative new ways to express the slogan overnight. Variations included GFHGSDGM, the initials of the chant's romanticized Chinese characters, and 3639-0242, which shares a similar pronunciation in Cantonese. Kyoto in the Japan Times. Japan's single mothers and female workers hard hit by coronavirus. Based on a labor market survey in April, the employed population of women dropped by 530,000 from the same month the previous year to 29.3 million, the first such downward shift in over 8 years. Overall, unemployment has risen for 3 straight months through May for the first time since it worsened for 6 months in a row from February to July in 2009 in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, according to government data. Matthew Dorn in ABC News Australia. Government powers mean Attorney General will decide if ABC journalist will be prosecuted. In 2017, the ABC published a series of stories, now known as the Afghan Files, detailing serious allegations of misconduct by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. The story was based on leaked classified information, prompting the Defense Department to call in the Australian Federal Police to investigate the source. If, and it is still an if, the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions wants to pursue Mr. Oakes in a criminal court, the Attorney General, Christian Porter, will have to decide whether the charges should be laid. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Seattle Times, a COVID-19 outbreak on UW's Greek Row hints at how hard it might be to open colleges this fall. As of Friday, 117 students living in 15 fraternity houses this summer have reported testing positive for the virus. The university has confirmed 89 of those cases, along with an additional 4 students who visited fraternities but did not live in them. The numbers are likely to tick upwards since about 1,000 have been tested, including other students who visited the fraternities but didn't live there. Most of the students are asymptomatic and none have gotten seriously ill. Kira Mouseth, a clinical psychologist and senior instructor at Seattle University, said students are desperate for connection in the wake of lockdowns and college-age adults tend to be risk-takers, not fully recognizing danger. And they also maintain a belief, as people of any age often do, that the illness will happen to other people, not to them. Brad Schmidt in the Oregonian, Oregon State Police don't wear coronavirus masks while patronizing coffee shop despite governor's order. A group of Oregon State Police troopers appeared to defy Governor Kate Brown's statewide mask order while in uniform Wednesday, entering a Corvallis coffee shop without wearing required face coverings, video obtained by the Oregonian shows. The store's assistant manager, Travis Boss, said he told the first trooper who arrived that the trooper needed to wear a mask. Quote, he said, F Kate Brown, Boss recalled. Kevin Tarach in Czech News, Victoria Duo's online roller skating classes go global. Andrea Boys and Martin Newham teach and rent out roller skates in the greater Victoria area. With COVID-19 forcing people around the world to adopt a more isolated lifestyle, roller skating has seen a global resurgence. So far, they've attracted over 100 students from all across the globe. The students range in age and skill level, with the youngest being 5 and the oldest 65. And these headlines this week in the Breaker.News. A tale of two reports at BC's Legislative Assembly Management Committee as RCMP continues to investigate James Lenz. COVID exclusive, BC taxpayers face giant hotel bill for quarantining travelers and foreign workers. RCMP investigation of ex-Olympic CEO tainted by racism, conflict of interest, say members of Northern BC First Nation. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. We made it halfway, that is. 2020 is so far the year that feels like a decade, with U.S. and Iran tension to start, then shut down Canada, the coronavirus pandemic, a sudden recession, Black Lives Matter, the road to the U.S. presidential election. On that note, I'm featuring some of the highlights of the first 6 months of the year from past editions of the Breaker.News podcast. Let's start at the beginning, edition number 115, the week of January 5th, 2020. Mario Canseco of Research Co. joined me. He gazed into his crystal ball from BC, British Columbia, to DC, Washington, District of Columbia. Will there be an early election in BC?
There's not a lot of traction related to Andrew Wilkinson. His numbers aren't really climbing the charts. The Greens do fairly well in some places, but not outside of the island. And the NDP seems to be very popular. Even people who voted for the Liberals look at John Horgan as somebody who's running the show slightly well, and there's no animosity that is as all-encompassing as what we saw in the latter stages of the NDP in the 90s to suggest that there would be a change of government.
Will Trump get reelected? U.S. and Iran tension reignited to start the year. The U.S. killed a general visiting Iraq, and Iran retaliated by shooting down a Ukrainian plane, killing 176 innocent people, including 63 Canadians.
I think it's important for anybody who looks at American politics to look at the effect that a wartime president can have on something. You know, we were discussing, we can go back to the first Nixon re-election and how a lot of people weren't particularly satisfied with the way things were going, and he ended up getting a huge majority. Similar situation when it comes to George W. Bush, who ended up defeating John Kerry and getting more electoral votes and more votes as far as the actual popular vote than he got in 2000 versus Al Gore. So wartime presidents tend to do very well. I think it'll be a very different type of wartime president. I don't think we'll see an all-out invasion or something that is similar to the shock and awe that we saw in the earlier years of this century.
On edition number 118, the week of January 26th, 2020, Huawei Chief Financial Officer Meng Wanzhou's first day of the first phase of her extradition hearings was overshadowed by a bizarre protest. A couple dozen people, apparently in their late teens or early 20s, were holding signs that read, "Free Ms. Meng, bring Michael home, Trump stop bullying us, equal justice." But none of the protesters I talked to really had any knowledge or passion for the cause.
What group are you with, and why do you want Ms. Meng freed?
We just want equal justice.
Equal justice? How's equal justice? Are you aware of the extradition treaty?
I'm not aware.
You're not aware of the extradition treaty or the facts of the case?
No, I'm not.
I would have known it was something paid to protest in a real scenario about something that I don't even know about. I would have never done that.
For Huawei's part, it denied any involvement in the phony protest. At the end of May, Meng eventually lost her first bid to leave Canada when a judge decided that the U.S. fraud charges against her were compatible with Canadian law, a principle known as double criminality. The case continues in August and September. On edition number 122, February 23rd, part of a series marking 10 years since the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics. It was supposed to be a celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics. Instead, John Furlong, the 2010 Games CEO, floated a trial balloon. He thinks Vancouver should bid for the 2030 Winter Olympics. He said so on February 20th at the Fairmont Hotel Vancouver to the Greater Vancouver Board of Trade.
"And Olympic Games again could do as it did already once and bring us all together. It could unite our governments, inspire corporate goodwill, and ignite citizen engagement. A nonpartisan, all hands on deck focus to go beyond a shining oasis on a hill and become the most livable place on earth."
Lack of affordable housing, homelessness, traffic congestion. The 2010 Games were supposed to solve these problems. Simon Fraser University City Program Head Andy Yan joined me on the podcast to ponder the legacy of the Games.
It has, I think, a mixed legacy. I think that part of it is really fundamentally how there are still things we still don't know about the full disclosure of what happened to make the Olympics occur, as well as the actual full cost of the Olympics. Because it's not only about the layout for things like security and facilities, but the opportunity costs that were involved, the full expenses that were, if you will, subsidized by various levels of government. But I'd be very curious to see what it really costs, say, the city of Vancouver in terms of staffing and opportunity costs.
Edition number 124 for the week of March 8th, 2020. The Shut Down Canada protests were a nationwide campaign to shut down highways and railways in sympathy with Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs who wanted to stop construction of the Coastal GasLink pipeline in northern BC. The hereditary chiefs reached a truce with the BC and federal governments over their land claim. But protesters tried to shut down the legislature on Throne Speech Day in February, and they returned to set up a protest camp outside the parliament buildings. Less than a month later, the group met with the BC NDP Indigenous Relations Minister Scott Fraser and interim Green Party leader Adam Olson. The meeting backfired. The protesters refused to leave, and five were eventually arrested by Victoria Police.
"And he stated that he will not stand with us. He will not exercise his power to ask Coastal GasLink to stand down. And so we are staying here until Coastal GasLink is removed from Wet'suwet'en territories, or we are removed from this building."
"Apparently, Vicky is here."
"Pizza's not pipelines."
"Apparently, Vicky is here."
"So apparently Vic PD is here, so I should get in this slice."
"Five people at the fire ground."
"Mm.
Hi, yeah, almost locked."
"This is great pizza, by the way. I highly recommend." "This is from Fresh Slice. Pizza of the Resistance." "Definitely shout out to Fresh Slice."
"Honorable Speaker, there was an agreement that the We had a respectful discussion, but there was an agreement and a commitment that they did not honour, that they would leave following the event. But, Honourable Speaker, I'm deeply disappointed, obviously, that they broke their word.
They had articulated in a very powerful way the challenges that they face. And I think that there was definitely a much better understanding going out of that. But I think that it then gets to the distraction is that they decided to leverage that opportunity. And I think that it, you know, from talking to my colleagues, I think that there's a lot of people that focused on that rather than focused on the good work that they had done.
The protest camp packed up the next morning. Ellen Mullen, chief of staff for Speaker Del Plekis.
But they certainly weren't expecting what we saw on Wednesday night. You know, I just think it was such a grossly unfair waste of the police time. They did have to call in reinforcements, and I know they did call in members who were not on shift in on overtime just as that support. But like I've previously stated, Bob, everybody has a right, you know, to be heard, but everybody also has a right to be protected and feel safe by their police force. And that was taken away in large extent for the people of Victoria last night.
Edition number 128 of the Breaker.News podcast, the week of April 5th, 2020. Then came the pandemic. A once-in-a-century virus spread around the world. The Wuhan coronavirus, which the World Health Organization called COVID-19 after pressure from the Chinese government. In mid-February, Federal Health Minister Patty Hajdu balked at calls to stop travel from China. She was flanked at a news conference in Chinatown by Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart and BC Health Minister Adrian Dix. Hajdu complimented the People's Republic of China and said Canada was not going to close its borders.
I understand that there's some voices that would say that we should shut down the border to China. But I would say that Canada is following expert advice from the World Health Organization and working closely with allied partners like France and the UK and Germany, who have decided to take a different approach than the approach that the Australians and Americans have taken for a whole bunch of reasons. First being that it's much easier to support people from a region that's experienced such an outbreak if we know that where they're coming from. And the evidence says that when you shut down a border like that, it gets much harder to actually detect where people are coming from because people are determined to get into a country or a return home, and they will find alternative routes to do so. Secondly, the long-term implications of shutting down borders is one, they're not very effective in controlling disease, as in fact, they're not effective at all. And secondly, they actually long-term can create a greater risk to global public health. And here's why. China has been very open. Now, some will say, were they open enough and how fast were they open? But what we know is that within a week or so, they were letting the World Health Organization and therefore all of the partner countries know that they had an outbreak on their hand. And more than that, they were sharing the sequence of the virus, which was really important to other countries like Canada to be able to have the evidence to do the investigation and the testing in Canada. Imagine now if countries were to suspect that if they had an outbreak, the border would get closed, there would be sanctions economically, and all of a sudden that transparency that the world relies on in order to defeat viruses like coronavirus and protect the health of their citizens. Imagine if, in fact, countries stopped sharing that information. We would, in a global health sense, be in a bit of a pickle, if you will.
Top officials from various levels of government had a shaky start after the World Health Organization Pandemic Emergency Declaration on March 11th. On edition number 126, the week of March 22nd, 2020. At first, Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart said he would not declare a state of local emergency in Vancouver. Here is what he said on March 16th to the media.
At this point, we don't see a need operationally to declare a state of emergency. You can imagine a number of things happen when you do that. But if we did do it, it would really centralize power in the city, allowing us to take extraordinary measures, like, say, for example, secure hotel space, to deliver clothing, to deliver food, to disperse groups of people. So it really is the top level we can go to.
2 days later, Kennedy Stewart changed his tune after some restaurants and pubs ignored the ban on St. Patrick's Day parties.
After taking the best advice from health officials, Fire Chief Daryl Reed, and Police Chief Adam Palmer, I have decided we need to declare a state of emergency in Vancouver.
More from edition 128, the week of April 5th, 2020. BC's provincial health officer, Dr. Bonnie Henry, was similarly reluctant, and she also changed her tune. Exhibit A, March 13th, Friday the 13th, 2 days after the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, and just 1 day after banning public gatherings of 250 or more people in BC, Henry encouraged British Columbians to get out and enjoy the last weekend of winter.
You know, there are many things we can do. We're not talking about shutting down society here. We are, it's still very safe today in BC, all across BC, to go out, to go shopping, to go to restaurants. And in particular, we have a lot of things that we can do outdoors, which are very safe things to do. This virus does not transmit when people are outdoors. So go outside and play with your family. Go up to our ski hills. Go up to Whistler. Go out and experience what we have here in British Columbia right now.
March 17th, Henry declares a public health emergency in BC.
We have taken the extra step of declaring a public health emergency in the province of British Columbia.
British Columbia Premier John Horgan.
It'll be the worst St. Patrick's Day ever, I expect, in terms of the hospitality sector, which depends on this day to be a boost for sales. Well, it's not going to happen, but that doesn't mean we can't find other ways in the days and, well, more importantly, the weeks and months ahead.
BC Solicitor General Mike Farnworth on March 18th, the day after the health emergency was declared.
I am declaring a provincial state of emergency to support our provincial health officer and Minister of Health in swift and powerful response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Edition 127 of the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 29th, 2020. The International Olympic Committee stubbornly moved forward with the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics. Then it decided to strike a review committee and delay a decision by a month. Then the Canadian Olympic Committee announced it would boycott the Games. The world could not wait for the IOC and its committee. So the IOC bent to global pressure and postponed the Games to 2021, a first in Olympic history. With typical Canadian modesty, Canadian Olympic Committee President Tricia Smith reflected on the bold move.
You know that this decision was made, it was a very difficult decision, and it was made really domestically. We had to make this decision for the safety of our athletes and to contribute our part to controlling this virus. I do think it is a factor and one of the many factors that had to be taken into account when the further decisions were being made. And we provided additional information to the IOC on how exactly this was affecting our athletes, how exactly we came to the determination that it was not safe to continue in this present situation, and that we had to make this decision. So I think the information that we provided to them likely would have helped in the decision.
Back to edition number 126, March 22nd, 2020. Sean Holman was our guest. As in war, the first casualty of the pandemic was the truth. Media access to politicians, government buildings and offices, courts and libraries was suddenly stopped. Freedom of information laws were suspended. Sean Holman, the professor of journalism at Mount Royal University in Calgary, explained why we need more transparency, not less, during a crisis.
Well, it's important to understand first why we value information in the first place in democracies. And really, there's two main reasons. The first is control, the idea that with information we can make better decisions about the world around us and thereby control public and private institutions. And the second reason we value information is certainty. It allows us to feel more certain, especially during uncertain times. And that certainly is the case today. So if we think about those two reasons, that's really why we want more information about what exactly is going on when it comes to this particular public health crisis, because we can then better evaluate whether or not public bodies are doing the jobs that they should be doing when it comes to protecting us from disease, when it comes to protecting us from COVID-19, and we can then feel more certain about the fact that that job is actually being done. So transparency is more essential than ever before.
British Columbia health officials were not following the World Health Organization's recommendations to fight the virus. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
You cannot fight a fire
blindfolded. And we cannot stop this pandemic if we don't know who is infected. We have a simple message for all countries. Test, test, test. Test every suspected case.
Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry.
We won't be testing most people. We'll only be testing people who are in hospital or where there's a cluster or where there's an outbreak potential so that we're able to manage those effectively.
Vancouver Coastal Health Chief Medical Officer Dr. Patricia Daly.
There is no need to test everybody who might have mild disease. Of course, for anyone who comes to our hospitals with more severe disease, we will do testing. We will test to identify outbreaks, and we will test healthcare workers who provide care to vulnerable people. That is what we call a smart testing strategy. You are not required to identify every case to control the spread of this.
The last word goes to a doctor on the front line who is blowing the whistle on BC's lack of testing for coronavirus, Dr. Sean Wurmsbecker.
But today, really for me, hammered home one of the frustrations that we're seeing as frontline providers, and that's the fact that based on our current resources, we are very much under-testing the population. We're going to be really, you know, low-balling the actual numbers. And I saw several cases today that I have no doubt are positive cases.
BC's Health Minister Adrian Dix misled the legislature on March 23rd about testing stats.
In the last 2 days over the weekend, approximately 3,500 tests a day.
The actual coronavirus test numbers in British Columbia, 1,963 on March 21st, 2,036 on March 22nd. Only once has BC approached 3,500 in a single day. That was 3,480 on March 16th. After donating tons of masks and gloves and other PPE to China in early March, Canadian hospitals were suddenly running out. Evidence emerged of China cornering the world market, buying up Canadian supplies for export to China, just as the virus started its spread across Canada. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau faced questions about two chartered Canadian jets that came back empty from Shanghai without any PPE. On April 21st, a clearly embarrassed Prime Minister Justin Trudeau reacted to the news revealed by Conservative leader Andrew Scheer.
I got more information on the issues around the two planes that landed empty yesterday. One was a Government of Canada charter. The other was chartered by a specific province for one of their orders. There are severe restrictions on the ground in China in terms of how long a plane can actually stay in their airports before having to leave, whether it's full or not. And at the same time, supply lines and truck shipments to the airports are difficult and interrupted by checkpoints and quarantine measures. For the most part, we've been able to navigate through those and ensure that Canada has received the equipment that it needs. But these two airplanes were forced to take off empty.
In BC, reporters challenged Dr. Bonnie Henry on why she was hiding information about the spread of the virus in BC communities, while other provinces and states were providing anonymized information about cases in their communities.
You've been asked many times why you're not identifying communities in which COVID-19 patients are located, and I can recite from memory your answers, those being privacy reasons, you don't want to discourage people from coming forward, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you've also said all of your decisions are based on the best available evidence. So can you tell me on which evidence this non-disclosure policy is based? And if I may, Minister Dix, the governments of Alberta, Ontario, and Quebec all report cases at the community level. Will you reconsider this policy? Thank you.
So this is not a non-disclosure policy. This is how we do business in terms of public health.
For the record, the Oxford Dictionary defines non-disclosure as the fact or practice of not making information known. And Oxford also defines policy as a course or principle of action adopted or proposed by an organization or individual. Elsewhere, edition number 132 of the Breaker.News podcast on May 3rd, 2020. Meanwhile, what was going on in Surrey, British Columbia's second biggest city? The Breaker.News revealed that Mayor Doug McCallum and Councillor Alison Patton, both of the Safe Surrey Coalition, had a personal and a business relationship. Former Surrey Mayor Bob Bowes was on the podcast, and he said that Patton and McCallum need to set the record straight about their apparent conflict of interest.
That relationship, they be very transparent about it. If they have a relationship, that's their business, but their conduct in office can't be judged properly without understanding what their relationships are. Are they acting independently in terms of discharge of their public responsibilities, or are their decisions compromised by relationship? You know, as Trudeau said, the state has no business in the bedrooms of the community, but you know, transparency is also imperative here.
Edition number 134, May 17th, 2020, on the Breaker.News podcast, a cautionary tale from Australia, where University of Queensland student Drew Pavlou was expelled. He joined me on the podcast to talk about protesting against the Chinese Communist Party's growing influence on campus and Australia's reliance on high-paying overseas students at the expense of free speech.
They've been prepared to sell out democratic values, some of the most important values we hold dear in Australia, simply for private, personal, economic gain. It's a process of elite capture, and the Chinese Communist Party has really perfected it over the past few decades, and we're now seeing it in action. And Australia is really the canary in the coal mine when it comes to this type of thing. Unfortunately, we're going to be seeing it all across, I guess, democracies into the future. We'll see it in Canada. We'll see it in the United States. We'll see it in New Zealand. We'll see it everywhere, really. We'll see it in the European Union and Great Britain. It's a process of elite capture. The Chinese Communist Party has perfected it over decades. And now we are waking up to it, but it seems like we are waking up to it far too late. And that's really the really horrifying and terrifying thing. And we are now, like, really forced to reckon with the fact that we've basically, you know, we've been sleepwalking the past 30 years. We knew this government, Tiananmen occurred 1989. We knew what this government was like then. That was the true face of this government, rolling over students with tanks, crushing their legs and their bodies beneath, like, tank machinery. That was the true face of this government. The world learned it in 1989, and yet we've somehow been sleepwalking for 30 years.
And finally, edition number 137 on June 7th, 2020, the Breaker.News podcast dedicated the edition to the memory of Dermot Travis. Integrity BC's Dermot Travis, a watchdog whose voice became the most important in the post-Olympic BC, died of liver and heart illness on June 1st.
If you don't want to answer questions from the public, then don't run for public office. The same types of documents that you might want to access through freedom of information related to any type of financial transaction in any other part of government should apply to the legislature as well.
A one-off backroom special deal for the government of China, a country with one of the most deplorable human rights records in the world, being allowed to wine and dine our elected officials across British Columbia, and certainly they spare no expense.
Sean Holman is professor of journalism at Mount Royal University in Calgary.
Dermot meant accountability for British Columbia.
Vancouver's Wayne Crooks is the founder of Integrity BC.
Dermot focused upon the environment, human rights, integrity in government. His lasting legacy in British Columbia is the electoral finance reform.
Those are some of the highlights of the first half of 2020 from the Breaker.News podcast. Let's hope the second half of the year is better and brighter for everyone.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or a group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the emergency workers of British Columbia, those on the front lines of natural disasters. Right now it's flood season in British Columbia, and it could very well be forest fire season quickly too. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 5th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on July 5th in 1975, tennis great Arthur Ashe became the first black Wimbledon men's singles champion? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. Be like Paul Doroshenko, who is at the $10 a month NewsHound level of support for thebreaker.news. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.